G'day, it's Graham here from the Confident Man Project, and today I've got a very special guest. He's a mate of mine named Moose, and he's a transformation coach from meeteverymoment.com. And we're going to be talking today about how some of the ideas that he's got about transformational coaching can improve a guy's confidence. So welcome, Moose.
Thanks, Graham.
So look, I'm very interested to hear how you got into this whole coaching kind of thing. Like, what's your background?
Well, my background is, I guess, originally very academic, engineering, project management, design and build, so very practical. And then I fell ill. And through an 8-year journey of personal growth, healing, and exploring over about 30 modalities of healing, I discovered that there was quite a few things that weren't working for me in my life. Mm-hmm. And they all seem to lead to that illness. And my journey over the last 8 years has been to the application of those, and I think that's the crucial thing, the application of these methods of healing. And I'm not fully well now, but I've been on that journey. I know what it is to live that journey, and I'm now at a point where I had a choice of either going back into the previous work I did, and frankly, I don't think the world needs more displays or more technology. I think we need more presence and consciousness and connectedness and interconnectedness. So my passion is to follow that, and that's where I find myself at this point.
Right, that's interesting, because it does seem sometimes that the world's kind of heading in the other direction, right? More technology, more, you know, Google and these companies are like big money, big names, and yet you're saying that technology maybe is getting in the way of some things, and like it even impacted your health.
Yeah. Look, I think technology has its place. I believe it's a tool, just as our mind is a tool, but our feelings and our deeper knowing, our intuitive knowing is what should guide us. Mm-hmm. And when technology starts to compromise that, and in terms of connections between people and friendships and families, and you know, it's that classic example. You walk into a shop, you physically turned up, and you're standing in front of the shopkeeper. Mm-hmm. And someone calls on the phone, and he just completely goes, "Excuse me," and walks off and takes the phone call. So you've made the effort to connect and make an eye contact and really show up, and someone calling in gets immediate attention, and it's actually probably the shopkeeper's fear to let go of the fact that he might, you know, this call they'll ring back if it's important, or he can call them back, but actually the moment is presently in front of him. There's someone who's turned up in his shop and is present. Mm-hmm. And technology takes us away from, if you like, being connected and in intimacy between people, I believe. Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, and it sounds like there's this notion of presence that I keep coming across all the areas that I'm looking at as well, right?
Mm.
So what? Yes. How would you define that? Like, what is it?
Presence for me is to have an inner relationship with myself, moment to moment, whilst connecting with other people, and in also my doings of this other day.
Uh-huh. Okay. So how would you relate that to the idea of confidence?
Ah, yes, confidence. So I think we can be very easily outwardly confident, mm-hmm. whilst masking a deeper insecurity within ourselves. So for me, it's about having a relationship with myself, and being sure of that, and being truthful to that. So confidence is being truthful to that inner relationship to myself. And when I do that, I let go of all judgment of others, mm-hmm. all judgment of myself, and I move freely through the world as that expression, dance like no one is watching. That's what confidence is for me.
Mm-hmm. Because a lot of stuff that I've read about confidence has talked about the idea of, like, fake it till you make it, that you've got to kind of pretend. And that's not what I'm hearing you say. You're talking about a deeper inner sense or a deeper inner sensation, right?
Yeah, I think that's the goal. I don't think there's anything wrong with fake it till you make it.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that faking it till you make it is, well, I mean, not I believe. I have used that approach myself. And I believe there is a transition for us to move. Well, there's a number of transitions on that road to sort of inner knowing and knowing who we are. And I think it's very, yeah, I think there is a place to fake it till you make it.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, that's a bigger area of discussion perhaps, but it's, there's nothing wrong with faking it till you make it, because in fact, the whole point of faking it till you make it means that you're actually moving into a place of faith.
Mm-hmm.
At the point prior to that, you're willfully living, or at least this is my experience. I spent a lot of my life willfully living, trying to will things, make things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I put a lot of energy into trying to make things happen. And I believe that was one of the reasons I could exhausted, chronic fatigue syndrome.
Uh-huh.
And the point there is, it's about if you are willing in any given moment to fake it till you make it. Let's say you're going on a dance floor and you feel like you don't want to dance. The truth is, I know for a fact, if I get up there and give it a go, I've already shifted the energy.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I don't feel I'm faking the idea that I want to dance. But I know from previous experience that if I get up there and show up, you know, and take the risk of being vulnerable and people going, oh, he's a goofer or whatever, that's gonna shift my energy. And so there is it's really when the expression is fake it till you make it, but in that expression, I believe there is actually a willingness, not a willfulness, but a willingness to show up.
Mm.
That is what shifts and makes it work and has an effect on our lives.
Uh-huh. So it's like stepping outside your comfort zone. And I guess when you do that for the first time, you're not really going to know what to do and you're not necessarily going to know how it's going to go, right?
Absolutely. And the more you don't know how it's going to go, the more vulnerability and the more faking it till you make it, perhaps, and more potential growth you will get from that.
Uh-huh. So it's kind of like you've got to experiment and just try things and see. You don't. Some things might work and some things might fail, but you don't necessarily know that until you actually give it a go, right?
True. Yeah, I think that's very, yeah, very true.
Like, I'm really interested in the idea that we've got kind of like an intuitive brain, like an emotional intuitive brain, and then we've got this analytical rational brain, and we're very highly trained to get the rational analytical brain to do stuff, and society kind of teaches us that that's the way to be successful, right? But I'm interested in how to get in touch with intuition so we can act without having to do all that thinking and be more present. Because to me, that's key to actually having this kind of relaxed confidence that I'm working towards.
Mm.
And I don't know any way to get that intuition tuned up other than to actually try things and see what works. I guess you can also learn from other people, you know, which is why there are books that are helpful to read. But at the end of the day, you've actually got to take some kind of action, not necessarily knowing exactly how it's going to go.
Yes, I'm slightly fortuitous here, but there is, it reminds me of this story of Jill Bolt Taylor, who had a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
And she instantaneously experienced that euphoria, that innate knowing that she's going to be okay, that oneness, you know, connectedness with the world, and a sense of, because one whole half of hemisphere of her brain, which was the left side of her brain, had switched off, which is our logical side.
Mm-hmm.
And instantaneously she had that freedom, that you know, she didn't need to fake it till she make it, because she was it was a you know, in that energetic sense, she had lost all judgment of others and of herself, and also rational ability to even dial her telephone number and call for an ambulance. So she was basically floating in this euphoric state and just unable to do what anyone who's, you know, as a neuro, I think she was a neuroscientist, as a neuroscientist, she knew what was going on. And yet she didn't have the cognition or the, you know, to change her state because she was in a euphoric state, all the while being at very risk from becoming seriously injured or dying. So I think, I mean, obviously that's like fortuitous. We're not all going to choose to have a stroke.
No.
I guess the point here is if you really embrace what that story and that experience of Gilbert Taylor says, that it is possible to have this experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think your question was how do we get more in touch with that? Is that your question?
Yeah, like I love the idea of floating in a euphoric state and everything that that involves, but not the idea of having a stroke. So are there other ways of getting there?
Other injuries or other illnesses?
Yeah, maybe not involving injuries and illness.
Well, one thing which comes up for me is, first of all, there has to be a longing.
Uh-huh.
And if there isn't a longing, nothing's going to change. And that may not—you may not even be conscious of the longing. It may just, you know, you may unconsciously sort of move in a direction. But some level in our psyche, there has to be a longing.
Mm-hmm.
My belief, or at least my experience, has been that most to affect change, I split interventions or the styles of trying to get to this state into two different camps. One is passive,
uh-huh.
and the other is active. So if I go to the doctor and say, hey doc, you know, I've got this pain, or I'm too excited, too much anxiety, what can I do about this? I take a pill, that's passive.
Uh-huh.
However, and also I would put something like going to a chiropractor in that, where you lie there and just you do nothing. There is an element of active choice that you went and did that,
mm-hmm.
but mostly it's passive. And then for me, there's the active behavior one can take. So, for example, that would be meditating or trying becoming aware of our feelings and thoughts, and if they're not serving us, choosing a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I'm about helping people unlearn behavior that hasn't served them and put in appropriate behavior so they can then create. So that's my model of or approach.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. You just mentioned talking about feelings and thoughts that are not serving us. Could you give us some examples of those sort of things?
So you knock a cup of tea over and you go, God, I'm an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
That's a thought which, you know, you're even speaking aloud sometimes. People speak aloud. And it's a judgment of ourselves, which we also, if we're judging ourselves in that way, most likely we're judging everyone else around us in that way. And across the board, we just, you know, it's a very simple example, but it goes very deep because we hear, as a, you know, sentient being, mind, body, spirit, we hear that message.
Mm-hmm.
And at some level we're saying it to ourselves because we don't feel worthy. So first is to become aware of this internal commentary. It may be outspoken or, you know, both to outwards towards others and also internally towards ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I guess a bigger example would be, you know, you're going to an interview and you're going, well, God, I've never got a job at this level. It's very unlikely I'm going to get this job. If you were to say that to yourself, it's not going to serve you.
Uh-huh. So how does that kind of pan out? Like, do those things, do you really think those little tiny things we say to ourselves are significant?
I didn't used to. But as I've gone further down this journey, I've realized that they're iconic, they're symbolic of my state of mind, body, spirit, well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know about you, but I notice these days I'm much more sensitive or much more aware to other people's energy because I'm no longer numbing myself out. And I pick up when someone is perhaps smiling at me, but actually delivering me quite an, you know, a harsh blow, below the, a sideways hit in the belly. And I feel that energy, and it is very destructive, I believe. It's very, and I say that because it's something I am still capable of doing, you know, not really connecting with someone and using humor to distance myself, and also be non-confrontational and non-committal in what I'm saying.
Uh-huh.
So effectively, you know, the other person gets maybe a smile or a way of being that on conventionally says, hey, I'm a friendly sort of guy, I'm here, I'm available. But what I'm really doing under that is I'm jabbing them in the ribs and saying, fuck you.
Uh-huh.
Now, to me, if you look at that, if I go around jabbing my friends in the wrist and saying, fuck you,
mm-hmm.
All the while pretending, you know, and this is, you know, used to happen very unconsciously for me. It's now conscious and largely I'm hoping it's not, you know, a daily activity for me anymore. But it was a place that I lived from. And it took me many years to drop into awareness that was really going on, because it was how I'd always been, or my behavior had always been.
Uh-huh. So what I'm hearing is that, like, what they've called passive-aggressive forms of, you know, like you're smiling at someone, you're not really congruent because you're smiling at them, but really what you're saying or doing is intended to hurt them, because you're actually angry, but you don't want to reveal that.
Yes.
Oh. Because to reveal that you're angry might show some defect of character of your own, or it might involve a level of intimacy that, you know, because under anger there's often hurt. So actually you might be hurt that they've done something to you, and you definitely don't want to show them that. So instead you make some comment in a joking form that is actually intended. It's got a barb attached to it, right?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. But that's so common. Like, I do that. Everyone I know does that, you know, a lot of the time. So where does that stuff come from? I hear you got planes flying overhead there.
That's very loud, is it? We don't really get planes down here, so I don't know why.
Yeah, well, you're only...
It must be the wind direction.
Yeah, I mean, you're just across the bay from an airport, so I've no idea how that can happen.
Well, no, it's not a barb in that grab. Is that a straight joke or a... Well, we are across from the airport, but as I say, the flight path is normally, we get saved, we don't have to experience it, so.
Right, cool, yeah.
Yeah.
There might have been a barb in that, I don't know.
I definitely didn't feel it was a straight joke. It was a sort of like, are you an idiot? You live next to an airport. That's a good example, really, because I guess in a way, this is a really trivial little moment.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But was, and the thing about humor is often it's funniest when it's really close to the bone.
Mm.
But the difference is it's okay to make the joke.
Yeah.
So long as you know that so long as it is purely about something that is not in, so long as you're not making that joke to save yourself from saying something that needs to be said. For the sake of a relationship and intimacy and connection.
Right.
If you're saying that if you've got a disgruntlement with X, you know, let's say you've got a disgruntlement with a friend, Fred, let's call him Fred, and you make a joke, and really that joke is because you feel a resentment or a disgruntlement, then there's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
If you've talked about the disgruntlement and it's clean and you both feel, you know, you've both got what needs to be said out of the way, you can have a laugh about it.
Yeah.
But I believe if you do it without that, without being committed and direct and walking towards the conflict in a calm in present way, and but you replace that with a joke, then there's a problem.
Mm.
And as you say, it is, we're all doing it. And this is, I guess, the beauty of life, is that we go to university, or we study, or we don't, you know, finish school and we go into the world. And the truth is, we're not taught this stuff.
Mm.
And for me, that's a really sad thing, because it took me a long time to realize I needed to learn it. And then it took me a long time trying different modalities, 30 different modalities to get to that place of awareness.